Okay, we're now doing side three of session 16, September 12, 2006, and we're finishing up the LaRouche essay. It's called How to Introduce Beethoven to American Laymen, and it was published in the Campaigner in September 1979, and we're on page 9 of that essay. And Scott's going to read the last paragraph.
Mm-hmm. From the standpoint of the Aristotelian and irrationalist empiricist positive schools, such as the Frankfurt School's protege, Arnold Schoenberg, down through Webern to Stockhausen and John Cage, the values of the notes are either properly determined as if they were self-evident atoms prior to any musical consideration, or purely arbitrary valuations might be given to them.
So he's implying that the ratios between notes is very important, and you can't play with combinations of them, arbitrary or whatever, which he says is like science playing with atoms.
Yeah, and he cites John Cage, who is being his sort of adversary here in that way. And
John Cage, the low point of
John
music.
Yeah, John Cage wasn't. My understanding of him was that he wasn't really trying to compose music according to rational aesthetics. He was more interested in looking at to the environment and seeing that there were already sounds of music going on in the environment that he could emphasize.
He was emphasizing sensory modalities,
sensory modalities,
the McLuhan way,
right?
Aristotelian way. LaRouche thinks there's some method of not being embedded in matter,
yeah,
or senses that is the more productive for civilization in general.
Yeah.
Let me just read that last section on the ephemerals. From the Platonic standpoint, the notes of the well-tempered system are ephemerals. It sounds like they're transient. The student must not be left misguided on the significance of that. Ephemeral is not equivalent to sloppy, arbitrary, or illusory. In other words, like hippie values. You know, you're only a Maya, so it doesn't matter what you're being. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Indeed, individual life is an ephemeral in the whole development of humanity, yet an individual person is not only definite, but what he or she may do to secure a meaningful place in the process of human development as a whole is also a definite matter. The notes within a well-tempered system, that's Bach's well-tempered system, have a determined exact value as notes. There's no caprice, no margin for indifference within the range of audible discriminations, you know, margin for beatnik indifference to life, since it's just Maya. So there's no caprice, no margin for indifference within the beats, or within the beats, but we produce nominal values. Let me read that again. There's no caprice, no margin for indifference within the range of audible discriminations, or within a tolerable range of beats produced by the variation between produced tones of the same nominal set of values. Tolerable range of beats produced by the variation between produced tones of the same nominal set of values. So he's talking about the process of discrimination. Continuing, when we insist that the values of notes are ephemeral, we are merely insisting that the values of musical notes are not determined a priori, independently of music, which would imply, like visual bass, McLuhan said, separated the speech from music and sound and instruments, broke it up. He's not doing that, in a way. We're merely insisting that the principles of lawful development necessary to affect beauty within musical composition rigorously determine the values of notes, with no obligation to any a prioristic assumption of what those sensual values must be independently of beautiful music. So again, he's bringing up the theme of assumption. Cannot impose assumptions and values about the note independently of the actual principles of making the music. And once you start to make the notes a priori, ephemeral, so that they can be arbitrarily changed from patterns, ignoring what creates it for music, beautiful music being coherent to the jazz box well-tempered system, if you do that, you're in trouble. And what will happen is, last paragraph, from the standpoint of the Aristotelian and irrationalist, or in brackets, empiricist positivist schools, he's calling the empiricisms and positivisms developments in science as irrationalist. Read that again. From the standpoint of the Aristotelian and irrationalist, or empiricist positivist schools, such as the Frankfurt School's protege Arnold Schoenberg, downward through Webern into Stockhausen and John Cage, the values of the notes are either properly determined as if they were self-evident atoms prior to any musical consideration, or purely arbitrary valuations might be given to them. He's saying that you determine like atoms, as separate entities that are determined within assumptions prior to their musical consideration, or just arbitrary valuations. That's the level, the meaning of ephemeral. He doesn't mean. That's ephemeral and as arbitrary. He means ephemeral that they are subject to the values and laws of coherent composition, not coherent in sort of being conservative, but to principles that allow contrapuntal development.
Does this have anything to do with the distinction between the diatonic and the chromatic scales?
Yeah, he may talk about that later. I mean, there are differences. I don't know what he says. If he says,
I'm not sure what scale he's talking about. He's just saying it's definitely not the 12-tone scale.
Yeah. He's saying that the notes and the scales are almost ephemeral, but not ephemeral. It's just like LaRouche, it does this up. He's saying, hey, you want to be a rebel, and you don't like the way the system is. You got to be very careful. You can't be just an anarchist or a romanticist or back-to-nature guy. You got to deal with the technological world you're living in and look at the misinterpretation of that and realize you got to make more science, so you got to be more rigorous. So when you drop out of the mainstream, you can't just be lazy, arbitrary, and consider life Maya. You actually got to work harder.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's applying that to music, to art, to science, to everything. You know what I'm saying? Because the idea of, as he said earlier, about being an iconoclast is something that has certain associations where you are indifferent to what people think and you stir up shit, so to speak. And that's not the correct way, the platonic way of being a iconoclast.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. In other words, the system may be, the establishment may be arbitrary or ephemeral from your point of view, but you got to deal with it realistically with the principle that our knowledge must develop technology that leads to a relative increased population density,
right.
Which, you know, in the 60s, 70s, 80s was a taboo thought. There's no way people wanted, in general, as the media presented people's concerns. They thought more people led to pollution, too many people being born, we need to cut back. There are whole institutions devoted to cutting back the world's population. So LaRouche takes on that as a real anti-environment,
mm-hmm.
He being the anti-environment. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So let's end with that. We got up to page 46, so we did a good chunk of LaRouche. And if for people who aren't as familiar with it as we're going along, as we are, it may have been too much, but I was trying to point out that he is repeating himself, applying the same pattern to different fields.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, we were talking about education, the Humboldt method. We talked about Nicholas of Cusa.
Who was Nicholas of Cusa? What was he about?
He one of his famous books is called The Doctrine of Ignorance. He was like a Menippean satirist.
Mm.
And he was a famous cardinal, famous thinker, and he developed some basic ideas that helped the Renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
I have to find the quotes, if we have them in the book, where it's particular what he did. What did he say here? Cusa's principal discoveries in science centered around his thorough reworking of the writings of Archimedes. In other words, he's retrieving, remember, they're just retrieving these Greek texts, and they're reworking what was 1,500 years old. Or more, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's just basic stuff from our point of view. But so he's reworking the writings of Archimedes, most emphatically Cusa's rediscovery of the isoperimetric principle of topology as a superior approach to that of Archimedes in treatment of the problem of quadrature of the circle. Pretty esoteric sort of geometric principles, but they were big deals back then.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was developments after him. There was Leonardo da Vinci, Kepler, Leibniz, Gauss, and then you just each century produces a new genius and moves it along. So that, you know, Cusa was a very early development in the retrieval of the Platonic method at the time of the Renaissance.
Mm-hmm. So, and the people he like are he likes Bach. Does he like Beethoven?
Oh yeah.
So he likes those guys.
Bach, Mozart, and Beethoven.
Uh-huh. The big three. And then he doesn't like Goethe, Mendelssohn, Wagner.
Yeah, now, Luther was a poet.
Oh, okay. Now, I know, now, Wagner did the Ring Trilogy.
Yes.
Which was pretty sort of a cult. It was, it had a certain mystical or cult flavor. I think Hitler was a big fan of Wagner's Ring Trilogy.
Yeah, no, that's true.
And, see, there's a certain metaphysic that that LaRouche doesn't like.
Yeah.
And it seems that it comes through in these composers that he doesn't like, or some of these scientists that he doesn't like.
It's those scientists who tended toward the speculative, what he called speculative Freemasonry, to emphasis on symbols.
Mm-hmm.
And symbols is antithetic to LaRouche's method, because you get stuck in worshiping, or all your thinking is like a fetish revolving around a symbol.
Right.
He's there to break symbol. And so the Romantics were symbolists, and the later symbolists, technically speaking, what we call the symbolists like Baudelaire and Rambo, symbol worshippers. And then the modernists were symbolic. So he's against symbolic Aristotelian Freemasonic speculative thinking, which leads to occult sensory rebellion against the humanist principles. In other words, he supports the Vatican on this issue.
Yeah. I don't know that Aristotle himself would have been big into the symbolism. I don't think that's what his intentions were.
No, no. He made a fetish out of categorization and organizing knowledge into categories.
Right.
He was the first encyclopedic person.
Yeah.
LaRouche was against the encyclopedic tradition.
Yeah.
Which
but that doesn't necessarily lead to mystical symbolism, the categorization of knowledge.
It leads to fetishism, and he sees mystical symbolism as fetish.
Uh-huh. Mm.
Because you think you know something, and you revolve everything around it.
Oh, yeah, I see. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, let's leave it at that, because I got to go.
Okay. Good enough.